Good evening. It's Saturday, March 28th, with Sharon Sloboda. I'm David Rosenberg, and this is the KPFA Evening News. The number of confirmed coronavirus infections worldwide topped 600,000 today as new cases stacked up quickly in Europe and the United States, and officials dug in for a long fight against the pandemic. The latest landmark came only 2 days after the world passed a 500,000 infections, according to a tally by the Johns Hopkins University, showing that much work remains to be done to slow the spread of the virus. It showed more than 615,000 cases and over 28,000 deaths. While the U.S. now leads the world in reported infections with more than 104,000 cases, five countries exceed its roughly 700 deaths: Italy, Spain, China, Iran, and France. Many observers have said the U.S. hasn't handled the coronavirus situation in the best way. Meryl Nass is a doctor of internal medicine who's been following the situation closely. We asked her what should have been done.
The first thing that everyone is aware of is that we did not immediately make plans to get enough gowns, gloves, masks, ventilators, and start training doctors and other paraprofessionals how to deal with ventilators and how to deal with this kind of case. Information was widespread in early February about what the illness looked like. And throughout February, we were getting more and more information so that a lot of planning could have been done. Corporations could have start retooling themselves and all of that. The other thing that was a terrible fail was the lack of testing. Tests were available from the WHO, were available from other countries, and for an unknown reason that makes no sense and that needs to be investigated, the CDC and FDA would not allow private companies, state laboratories, or anyone else to bring them tests that they had developed themselves and get them approved. And that persisted until February 29th, even though the FDA had only performed, I think, maybe 5,000 tests in the whole country by that time.
So you get the sense that other countries handled things better?
Yes. I mean, there was a lot more testing, for example, in South Korea or Singapore, China, parts of China. Once they realized what they were dealing with, they got up to speed pretty quickly.
And how about now? Granted that some things were done later than they should have been, what can be done now to protect the population?
Well, we have to know what we're going to have available to us when the peaks are here. So for example, in New York City, in some places, they don't have enough masks, gowns, gloves for the staff. One reason for that is because and I've been a doctor 39 years. Historically, there were very few patients that required this level of containment. There were very few things that traveled airborne, aerosolized within the hospital. So tuberculosis and norovirus were the two common ones. And so if a nurse in a 12-hour shift had to go into a room and see a patient six or eight times, she would have to completely gown up, including shoe covers, head covers, you know, face covers, the whole thing, six or eight times during that shift in disposable clothing, and then throw it away at the end. Maybe wash the mask. So not the mask, but the goggles. So we have a history of using disposable equipment in that way and not requiring very much of it. And so nobody anywhere had a sense, nor was it permitted by CDC, to actually reuse any of this stuff or figure out how to cohabit the patients so that you could put one set of gowns, gloves, masks, etc. on, maybe double glove, and wear it the whole day and only take care of coronavirus patients during that shift.
That's internal medicine doctor Meryl Nass.
Defender Europe 20, NATO's latest anti-Russian war games, has been canceled because Germany pulled out for fear of spreading COVID-19. The games were to be the latest training in transforming U.S. troops from the United States to Europe since the mid-1990s, with 1,500 German troops transporting military equipment across Germany and Poland to Russian borders. The Pentagon was determined to go ahead despite the pandemic, but Germany pulled its forces out and closed its roads to NATO troop movements for fear of spreading COVID-19. Norway canceled the Cold Response War Games on their Russian border as well, also for fear of spreading COVID-19. Pacifica's Anne Garrison spoke with Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space about further developments in the U.S. military.
Bruce, we had a conversation about the cancellation of the NATO War Games earlier this week. So first, I want to tell listeners where they can read that. It's on the websites of the San Francisco Bayview, sfbayview.com, and Black Agenda Report, blackagendareport.com. The headline is, Can COVID-19 Take Down NATO? Now, what are your thoughts about what's happened since?
Well, I've been reading The Stars and Stripes the last couple of days, and it's fascinating to see the stories about the what I would call a dramatic escalation of the virus at U.S. bases in, for example, Italy and Germany. There was an article that I was really moved by about the soldiers stuck in Kuwait. Several hundred of them were sent there temporarily, but now they're stuck there. One of them has a wife and newborn baby back home. They're being told to stay home. And of course, this GI is really worried about his family. And so you can just imagine that it's not going to take too long for these GIs worried about their families back in the United States. They're terrified about their own condition being stuck in some place around the world at some base where the virus is spreading. This is going to be a real problem for the military. I was watching a video of a colonel who was trying to reassure the people on his base in Vicenza, Italy, that everything was going to be all right. And there were comments in the scroll bar next to it. And I was reading some of them. And some of his GIs that he was responsible for were saying, we want to go home. We want to get the hell out of here. So this is going to become a problem for the Pentagon, whether it's on these aircraft carriers or these Navy destroyers or at these bases. It's going to be increasingly a problem. And I don't think they're going to have enough equipment to handle all of this. So it's a real, real bad situation.
Military Times reported several days ago that infection in the U.S. military jumped by 60% this week to a higher rate than the general U.S. population. This is likely to become especially traumatic in the Navy, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, they're cramped. The living quarters are cramped. There's not much you can do about that on a, say, for example, a submarine or a destroyer or an aircraft carrier. I was never in the Navy. I was in the Air Force, but I've seen a lot of pictures over the years of the way people live on ships, and there isn't much room. That's going to become a real problem if the virus begins to really spread. So what's the alternative? You go into some port of call, and pretty soon it's going to be like the cruise ships. The people that you're coming into their country, are they really going to want all those sailors to get off those ships? Where are they going to go? Stay in a local hotel? Oh, my God. Then that becomes a problem in the local community. The Navy's going to have some real big situations to deal with here.
The number of infections in the U.S. is now higher than any place else on Earth. And we don't have the infrastructure to respond. But we've got troops and bases all over the world. This is kind of humiliating, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole U.S. BS exceptionalism story is just being deflated in a big way right now all around the world. It's being exposed. You know, it's always been a public relations scam. Hollywood, Madison Avenue, it's like a bad movie that's finally on the air and being exposed with terrible reviews. So that's what we've got. And it's all a mirage.
And that was Bruce Gagnon, co-founder and coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
Some human rights advocates are concerned that the emergency measures taken by governments around the world to combat the coronavirus could become permanent. To get a sense of how things might go in the U.S., KPFA spoke with Diablo College philosophy professor Robert Abley. Human rights in the time of the coronavirus, what's your sense of how things are going that way? Do you think governments are going to use this emergency to crack down hard on the population in general? Or do you think this is just one of those things that has to be done that has nothing to do with increasing authoritarian control?
As a general view, governments have a very unfortunate proclivity for using emergencies to increase their power and cracking down on individuals. And I think we see some of this going on already with the Trump administration. And I don't think they're any different from any other administration. We saw saw the Bush administration do this with habeas corpus back in 2006, trying to get rid of habeas corpus. But the Trump administration's Justice Department asked Congress to craft legislation to indefinitely hold people on trial and suspend some of their constitutionally protected rights during the coronavirus. And that includes, if I can read directly from the DOJ statement, that they would apply, this suspension of rights would apply to any statute or rules of procedure otherwise affecting pre-arrest, post-arrest, pre-trial, trial, and post-trial procedures. In other words, it would be a suspension of habeas corpus for someone that was arrested that could go on until any emergency came to a close and a judge would make the determination that that emergency was over. That would mean that a person could be arrested now and be held in jail indefinitely until that judge decided that the emergency time in which they were arrested had come to an end. So until the judge would decide that the coronavirus, for example, is no longer a threat, that person would be held in jail. So that would be a complete end to habeas corpus. And that very
was that suspended for a while in U.S. history? Was it during the Civil War? Were there certain times when that right was taken away?
Yeah, it's been suspended several times in U.S. history. 1861, Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus. President Bush suspended habeas corpus in 2001. He tried it again in 2006. 1870s, President Grant suspended habeas corpus. So if this goes through, this will be the fourth time that the U.S. government has attempted to suspend habeas corpus. So yeah, they've tried it before. And it's in each case, it's been an appeal by the government to a state of emergency that has existed in the United States, a domestic state of emergency. So yeah, it's been tried before.
And looking at what's going on in other countries, do you get any sense there? I guess Italy would be a closer example than China because it has a ostensibly democratic government. What do you see there that could have relevance for the U.S.?
Well, not a suspension of habeas corpus. I don't think we've seen that there. So I don't know that they have any direct bearing on the issue of rights for us. I think one of the things that we see in Italy that it would be good to learn from them is that their sense of community is a little bit tighter than ours. We have a sense of individualism and a freedom to do whatever we want, and we don't have that sense of a common good. I think Italians have a little bit better sense of that, and the result is that when the particular governmental administration says we need you to lock down and stay at home, Italians have a more of a tendency to do that than Americans have a tendency to do that. So I think we could learn that. But they haven't done anything like suspending habeas corpus in Italy.
Abley says people should be concerned when government officials start to use rhetoric that puts the country on a warlike footing, which he says is the antithesis of freedom.
At least 15,000 people who may have caught the new coronavirus from a Sikh religious leader are under strict quarantine in northern India after the man died of COVID-19. The 70-year-old guru, Baldev Singh, had returned from a trip to Europe's virus epicenter, Italy and Germany, before he went preaching in more than a dozen villages in the Punjab state. According to a local deputy police commissioner, 19 people who were in contact with the preacher have already tested positive for the virus. Results are awaited for more than 200 other people who were tested. The case has sparked one of India's most serious alerts since the pandemic, with special food deliveries made to each household, even under tighter restrictions than the strict 21-day nationwide stay-at-home order imposed by the government.
Angela Merkel has urged Germans to continue to cooperate with a nationwide shutdown aimed at halting the coronavirus pandemic, arguing that the large number of daily infections means that the measures must remain in place. In a weekly podcast, the German chancellor thanked the nation for complying with a comprehensive shutdown of non-essential activities, as well as for following social distancing guidelines, but said that the country was still a long way from returning to normal. Our chief of staff, Helga Braun, said today that the measures will not be eased before at least April 20th.
Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe today promised an unprecedented package of steps to cushion the world's third biggest economy from the coronavirus pandemic, saying the country was close to a national emergency as infections surged. Abe said the huge, powerful measures will include fiscal stimulus, monetary steps, and tax breaks for companies, though the details have not been finalized. According to public broadcaster NHK, Infections in Japan have climbed to more than 1,500, with 52 deaths, excluding those from a cruise ship quarantined last month. NHK said that officials confirmed a further 63 cases in Tokyo, and today announced 57 new coronavirus cases at a center for the disabled in the Chiba Prefecture near the capital.
And you are listening to the evening news on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, K248BR in Santa Cruz, and KPFA.org with Sharon Sloboda. I'm David Rosenberg.
As the coronavirus pandemic has forced most of us to shelter in place, every aspect of our lives, including the ways in which we experience and appreciate art, has changed. This month, Josefina Lopez had just begun the relaunch of her play, Real Women Have Curves. She wrote the work of art decades ago, and it was quickly optioned into a film. I spoke with her in anticipation of the play's relaunch at the San Francisco Playhouse in time for Women's History Month, which runs through the end of March. However, with the lockdown order, the play has been suspended. In the spirit of Women's History Month, Josefina Lopez spoke about the writer's journey of highlighting significant events, issues, and moments in time.
I wanted to celebrate the contributions of Latinos to the economy because I feel like we've been left out of the history books, especially in 1987 when I was just graduating from high school, you know, and because I was undocumented, I couldn't go to college right away. So I spent a year in the sewing factory. So the play captured that experience of working with these women and understanding that women are powerful and seeing my mother as a feminist, a third world feminist. And so I wanted to write this play to tell this amazing experience I had that was so educational for me as a woman, as a feminist. And so I wrote the play. And then at 21, it got produced in San Francisco. And because I was so young, and I got written up in the Pink Pages in San Francisco, a producer saw it, and so they optioned it. You know, I didn't know what I was doing, but anyway, the movie took 11 years to get made, and I learned a lot about how movies get made and how long it takes and how frustrating working as a screenwriter really is. And so the movie got made, and with the help of George LaVue, who helped me produce it and co-write it, and it was a dream come true. It won the Sundance Audience Award in 2002, and it also won the Acting Award for America Ferrera and Lupe Ontiveros. And so it was, like, unbelievable.
And the play is coming around, it seems like, yeah, a second time. And you said perhaps because of the heightened tension around politics and immigration
debate, and people finally care because, you know, it's gotten so bad and so outrageous, especially when we see children being separated from their mothers. And, like, what justification do you have for taking away a baby from a mother? Like, how is that morally right and legally right? Like, it's just... So I think enough people have become allies that everybody's like, we care about this topic, you know? And of course, when I wrote about it, people didn't care. People didn't know, didn't understand. And now I'm so happy that people care. But, you know, there's so many topics that I've written about. Like, I've written about rape. I've written about everything that, like, we finally are talking about it. So sometimes as a writer, it's frustrating when you want to talk about things that no one wants to talk about. And sometimes you have to wait 10, 20 years until it becomes relevant. I tell people I declare myself a winner because with all the rejection that I've encountered, I've had a lot of successes. But if you look at all, like, you know, like, for every success, I've had maybe 20, 30 rejections.
Because this is the life of writers. For those of you who don't know, rejection is a huge part.
But here's the difference, okay? One of the things I got early on that really has helped me, especially with my sanity and my self-worth, is that always know that the rejection is always about the idea that they don't buy the idea, but not you. Don't ever make it personal. Because, you know, after I said, you know what, I have great ideas. And just because they reject it doesn't mean anything. It means they're not open to it. That's fine. There's 1,000 more people I can go to. It's a lot of work, but... and then somebody eventually does produce it or make it or publish it, whatever. And so I tell people, look... It's never about me. And if I ever make it about me, my self-worth, then that's a mirror to me to say, hey, love and embrace yourself. Yeah, because when you do that, nobody can reject you.
That was Josefina Lopez, the writer of Real Women Have Curves, speaking about her journey as a writer and about her play that was slated to hit the stage for a second time this month, but has been suspended due to the coronavirus pandemic.
With all the news about the danger of the coronavirus, it can be hard to maintain one's balance. but many spiritual teachers and health practitioners are trying to help people do just that. Lilia Roman is a yoga teacher and healing arts practitioner originally from Mexico. She talked about the coronavirus situations in the U.S. and Mexico and about what advice she gives her students in this very difficult period. What's the difference between being in Mexico and being in the U.S. in terms of the coronavirus? What have you noticed there?
What is happening in Mexico? I haven't been there lately, right? But for what I know from my sisters, my family, is that, I mean, there is a level of fear. But it's not the way that it is here. Here, there is so much of that fear and this panicking, and probably with some reason, right? With some good reason, because there is more of the spread of the virus here. I think more people are being affected here than in Mexico. And because for what we know about the virus is that the virus cannot survive in very hot weather, not yet, at least, right? Central Mexico is very hot, and there's not as many cases yet. As far as I know, there's only 4 people who have died from this virus, and they are not in very hot climates. They're more towards the north. So the spread of the virus is not really that bad as it is here.
Even in Mexico City?
Mm-hmm. Even in Mexico City.
You're a yoga teacher and you teach many people. And how do you deal with it as a spiritually oriented person? What do you tell your students during this time?
Well, it's very important to cultivate a sense of groundedness and resilience in the physical body, because we are being bombarded by so many news on the subject, and some of them are not even accurate. It's more about the hype and the fear and the don't do this, don't do that, do this, do that. And so we're being bombarded actually by all this information. And then I think I heard even some politician, someone say, make no mistake, we are in a war, you know, using words like that. And there's so much of that going on, like almost like sending the message of be very afraid, you know. So that's kind of what I hear constantly. So people are so vulnerable right now, and they have gone fully into the fear, into the reaction, into the panicking. So they are so much in the mind. It's more like the thought, the fear, the anxiety, you know, that kind of the constant thinking of the virus, of the virus, of the virus, and I'm going to get ill, I'm going to get sick, I'm going to die, I'm going to this, you know. So it's so much here, right, in our head. We're so much in our head right now. And if we keep listening to those news constantly, we're going to get ourselves sick. Right? We're going to make ourselves sick just thinking about it.
So there's how do you already get people, out of that mentality?
There's already people not sleeping well, living with anxiety and isolation. Plus, right, we have the isolation factor. So there's so much that we are dealing with here that is so negative to our well-being, our sense of well-being. And so I encourage people to move, to be connected to online communities if they don't want to go out for walks, right? Because a lot of people are afraid of going out even just for a walk. So stay connected online, at least to communities, you know, to classes. I offer classes online to my communities. They are donation based or for free. You know, whoever just cannot pay, they don't need to give anything. So it's just staying connected. We need to stay connected. We need to remember that we are in this together, that is a community, and we need to move our bodies, we need to breathe, we need to find also pause, not just move for the sake of moving, you know, but move in a conscious way, in a way that brings some strength to our bodies, our physical bodies, and some peace to our minds.
That's yoga teacher and healing arts practitioner Lilia Roman.
As the coronavirus has spread at pandemic proportions across the world, sections of the Middle East and South Asia have been particularly hard hit. China is stepping in to aid Pakistan in its efforts to combat the virus, and other countries like Iran are beginning to step up their efforts at containing it. KPFA's Lola Akamu has more.
The Pakistan Foreign Ministry said today that China sent a plane loaded with medical personnel and supplies to help Pakistan fight the spread of the coronavirus in one of the world's most populous nations. Across the Middle East and elsewhere, the outbreak has raised concerns that health systems strapped by multiple wars, refugee crises, and unstable economies won't be able to handle a growing number in cases. Iran is battling the worst outbreak in the region. Iranian state TV raised the death toll today by 139 people, pushing the total fatalities to 2,517 amid the 35,408 confirmed cases. Pakistan, with a population of 220 million, currently has 1,408 confirmed cases of the virus, including 11 deaths from COVID-19. Most of the infected people there were travelers returning from neighboring Iran. Pakistan has closed its borders with both Iran and Afghanistan, but has come under widespread criticism for its initial lax response to the virus. China has sought to portray itself as a global leader in the fight against the outbreak, which began a few months ago in its Wuhan province. Yesterday, China sent ventilators, masks, and other medical equipment to the South Asian country. Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan has refused to impose a countrywide lockdown, saying it would devastate the country's poor, but ordered non-essential businesses closed, including restaurants, money changers, and wedding halls. Pakistan is a key link in China's ambitious multi-billion dollar One Road project linking South and Central Asia with China. China is also a key military supplier for nuclear-armed Pakistan, having supplied the country with missiles capable of carrying atomic weapons. Even as the pandemic spread to the country, Pakistani authorities allowed tens of thousands of Islamic clerics from around the world to congregate for 3 days outside the eastern city of Lahore. Some 200 of the clerics are now quarantined on the site of the gathering. According to Pakistan's federal health authorities, the outbreak is so far concentrated in Punjab, with 490 confirmed cases there, and Sindh, which has 457 confirmed infections. Iran's officials have repeatedly insisted they have the outbreak under control despite concerns it could overwhelm the country's health facilities. Only in recent days have authorities ordered non-essential businesses to close and ban travel between cities. For KPFA News, I'm Lola Kumu.
According to an internal document reviewed by Reuters, Amazon.com Inc. is offering higher pay to recruit its own warehouse employees to pick and pack Whole Foods groceries amid rising demand and a worker shortage. This move, known as labor sharing, highlights how the e-commerce giant is reallocating some of its vast workforce to handle a spike in online sales of groceries as millions of Americans are stuck at home amid the COVID-19 outbreak. Amazon offers online grocery services through Amazon Fresh from its own grocery warehouses and Amazon Prime Now, which delivers from its Whole Foods stores. Employees who are selected to make the switch can make $19 per hour, a $2 raise on top of the pay hike Amazon announced earlier this month. Amazon Fresh positions require working in a freezer environment, while the Prime Now shopper role entails picking and packing. As part of additional measures to slow the spread of the virus across the country, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced today that domestic travel by plane or train will soon be off the table for anyone exhibiting symptoms of the coronavirus. The restrictions come into effect at noon Monday and apply to anyone showing signs of the virus, which include a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing. Those travelers will no longer be able to travel by air or rail between provinces and cities anywhere in Canada. The Prime Minister added that the federal government would be providing airlines and rail companies with further tools to bar those showing symptoms from getting on planes and trains, but did not explain what those enhanced screening measures would look like. And the weather for the Bay Area, lows around 50 tonight, rain on Sunday, highs around 60, lows around 50 degrees. And that's it for the news tonight. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Ann Garrison and Lola Kanmu for helping to prepare tonight's news. Carla West is at the controls. Thanks to Sharon Sabota for special technical assistance. With Sharon Sabota, I'm David Rosenberg. Good evening.